You're listening to the Locked In Podcast. Here's your host, Algernon Cash.
I'm Algernon Cash, and you're locked in. Welcome back. I feel so special today. Well, first of all, let me start off. Today is tax day, so that shouldn't make anyone feel special. I sort of woke up and a little bit disappointed that we had to go ahead and give Uncle Sam his take or his cut, as they call it. But I felt special this afternoon because Governor Pat McCrory, who is a candidate for the United States Senate, he locked in with us several weeks back. He's back again to update us on his bid for the United States Senate, and was just excited to have him back on the show. Governor, how are you today? Thank you for locking in.
I'm doing great. Cold Easter Monday, but I'm glad to be alive and have the opportunity to possibly serve in the U.S. Senate. We're traveling all over the state. We're getting our message out. We're trying to combat some about $10 million of negative ads directed toward me, which are just deceitful. I wouldn't mind if the negative ads were at least true, but when they're not true, it's almost impossible to respond when an outside group is accusing you of things that just are not even close to the truth. But, you know, that's the sad part of politics today.
Well, the biggest question of the day is, have you paid your taxes?
I did mine about a week and a half ago. The bad news is I actually quit about everything I'm involved in a year ago. So I didn't owe a lot of tax. In fact, I anticipate a refund because I actually didn't earn a lot this year because I quit everything in the name of public service to run for the U.S. Senate. Most people don't realize the only person who doesn't get paid in a campaign is the candidate. I know one of my opponents serves in Congress, they get to continue their salary, but I quit my radio station and everything. But how many opportunities in life do you get to serve? And I feel like I'm best qualified to serve the U.S. Senate based upon my experience as a mayor and a governor and growing up in Jamestown, North Carolina, and learning the values there.
Well, I'm sure Charlotte listeners also miss you, but you just mentioned, we'll jump into some of the issues. You just mentioned, obviously, you are a former governor here in North Carolina. North Carolina over the last, last couple of months have had some really, really big economic development announcements, a lot of new private sector jobs coming, a lot of new private sector investment is coming. But also with all that's coming is going to be more demands on our infrastructure. Right now, we're in a bit of a housing crisis right here in North Carolina in terms of supply and prices. You know, if elected to the United States Senate, what's your position on how do we create more affordable housing here in North Carolina, given all these big economic development announcements?
Well, the first thing we have to do regarding affordable housing is lower inflation. And the main reason we have inflation are two basic reasons. So one is energy. The reason the United States inflation has been so low for the past 25 years is because the energy costs have been maybe 1% a year. Inflation was 2.3% a year. Now it's probably over 10%. The Fed say 8.7. I guarantee it's over 10. And I talked to businesses 6 months ago, which were budgeting well over 10% inflation. But if our energy costs remain high, that also impacts the cost of goods and services to build houses. The second issue that impacts affordable housing and rents and people who want to buy is the cost of labor. And because we were giving out so much free money in the past year and a half, even when Trump was president near the end, we were giving out more money to not work than to work. That has increase the cost of everything. In fact, many of those costs have not been added on to the consumer as of yet. So labor and energy are the two major reasons for inflation at this point in time. And that's one of the major reasons there's a lack of housing due to the major lumber prices going up so much. And the other is the labor prices going up. And of course, the land prices going up. So those three factors are impacting that more than anything else. I did a lot of affordable housing as mayor of the city of Charlotte, but you also have to be very careful. What are the goals of affordable housing and your target audience? Is it the homeless? Is it renters? Is it people trying to get a home ownership, or is it all three? So the thing about affordable housing, it's much more complex in who your target audience is and where you're going to get the money to pay for it. And what are the long-term aspects of affordable housing? I'm a big advocate of Habitat for Humanity. In fact, I mentor a young man who lives in Habitat home, and thank God for it. And the other issue is buying land, which is the hardest thing to get, especially in major urban areas, whether it be Charlotte or Winston or Raleigh or so forth. Getting the land is very hard right now.
Yeah, I agree with some of what you said. Definitely agree with some of the points you made around supply chain disruption and disruption caused by the labor market, people not wanting to work, whether that be in construction or restaurants or a lot of these entry level jobs. How do we get people to want to get back to work? How do we shift the culture in America back to where it was?
Quit giving free money out. It's not that hard. I did it in 2013 when I became governor. We had the fourth highest unemployment rate in the country. And yet employers were telling me, hey, McCrory, we got job openings, no one's taking them. I'm going, why aren't they taking them? He says, because your unemployment compensation's higher than what we're paying, and we can't afford to pay anymore in an entry-level retail job, for example, or we go out of business. And also people, the auditing of people actually checking for employment was pretty lax in North Carolina. So I closed that down. I lowered the unemployment compensation of what Tennessee, South Carolina, and Virginia were paying. And that's when all my protesters started. Moral Monday, Reverend Barbara, they went nuts. And listen, I was empathizing. I wasn't sure it was the right decision. In fact, it took 3 months to lower unemployment. On the third month after we lowered unemployment and we paid off a $2.2 billion debt to the federal government for unemployment that we had borrowed, North Carolina had the largest drop in unemployment in the United States of America. It was the best decision I made as governor, but it was the most controversial, and it probably didn't help my polls. I know it didn't help my polls, but it helped Governor Cooper, my successor, because then he had money in the reserves for unemployment during COVID, and they paid off that debt, and he didn't have to increase taxes on employers who pay unemployment compensation. So I'm very, very proud of that decision. But the federal government under both Trump and Biden, there are people making $40,000 a year not working. I mean, what if you had the choice between working and making $35,000 and not working and making $40,000 plus benefits? I know what I'd choose. Well, I probably wouldn't, but I know what most people would choose, especially if you have family at home. Yeah. I'm not blaming the people for doing it. I'm just blaming
people making the best decisions for themselves. And
absolutely. I had a young kid I was mentoring who was going to go to college and he took unemployment instead. I was furious with him. I'm going, what are you doing? He says, well, I'm going to make $35,000 a year getting out of high school.
Yeah. One more question for you about the housing issue before I move on. And the reason I'm so concerned about this issue, because when I talk to people around the state of North Carolina, especially when I talk to elected officials and business leaders, there is a growing concern about housing. And you heard me mention some of the jobs that are coming to North Carolina from Boom and VinFast and Toyota and all the companies that are wanting to come into the state. If we don't have housing for their employees to live in, then we're basically going to lose those jobs to Virginia and to South Carolina. I know Toyota is on record saying that their employees are used to driving an hour and a half to come to work. So you technically could live in Martinsville and still be able to work here in our backyard. You know, one issue that I see when I go around the state, Governor, is that local governments are using the zoning laws to really prevent high density development, which is having an impact on the availability of housing.
Yeah.
Have we reached a point where there needs to be federal action to get some of these ambitious local governments to open up housing and higher density development in some of these communities?
Well, I don't agree with the federal government taking over the responsibility of local and state government. I think that's the responsibility of local county and city government that does most zoning. I don't want state government to take over city and county either zoning. And I had some Republicans for other reasons wanted to take over zoning decisions for like the city of Durham. And I said, I'm going to veto every one of them because you don't know about zoning. The people closest to the situation are best to make the zoning decision. And that's your county commissioners and your city council. And I don't want a Washington senator to do that for, I shouldn't have to make that decision for someone in Denver, Colorado. I don't know Denver, Colorado enough to make that decision. So I would disagree with that. But another thing that's happening with the inflation is interest rates are now going up, which are making everything else more expensive. And the rental issue is just going to bankrupt the middle class and starve the poor. If this, so I share your issues, but don't make the solution worse than the problem. And that's why I do agree with the local government, with some federal government, state government help getting involved in affordable housing. But you've got to be very specific of who your audience is. And they're different audiences with different needs. The homeless, for example, to get them into affordable housing, if you just provide them a home, you're probably not solving their problem because most likely there's a mental health or addiction issue. So you've thrown away that money and there's a good chance they don't have the means to keep up with that house. And that would be, that means you're thinking you're doing good, but you're not. You've got to solve their mental health and addiction issue before you give them the responsibility of a house or an apartment. And we've learned that over decades of research and trial and error that, you know, the house just goes to hell after you put all this money in. And then the neighbors, then you bring down the neighborhood. And
yeah, you need more so transitional housing.
Yeah, we saw this with Section 8. We saw this with Section 8 housing.
And I think a better phrase, and maybe I shouldn't have used the word affordable because I agree that that word has different connotations to it. Workforce housing, you know, just for people, you know, hardworking people who are just
That's the whole. So the strategy for workforce housing, and we do have a huge homeless problem, too. I mean, go down to any major urban center and you got people, and usually that's directly related to mental health or addiction. So that's one issue. But workforce housing is there's a gentrification going on in Winston and Raleigh and Charlotte of all these new people coming down with all this money. And they're kind of taking over the poor, what we used to be poor or quote, not the right neighborhood to move into. Well, now they're moving into it. And those people have nowhere to go, especially if they didn't own the property. So that's where government steps in, not doing what we did in the 60s. You know, in the 60s in Charlotte, for example, there was a primarily African-American community called Little Brooklyn right near downtown. It was slum housing. So what did government do under LBJ? They just mowed it all down and moved everyone to a project, you know, the projects, which good intentions, maybe. I'm not sure. Both good intentions and bad intentions. But it was the worst thing to do. You know, the high-rise Brooklyn public housing.
Well, and you concentrate poverty in one section, and that's never good. You want it to be diverse and mixed incomes and so forth.
I believe in I helped initiate what we call scattered site housing in Charlotte when I became mayor. But because you don't want to move people from a bad situation to a worse situation into a project, and then three generations stay in that project of high crime and poverty and no quitting school and. So what I did as mayor, I got waivers from the Bush administration to help with public housing at the time, quote, projects, because that's really what they were, and to incentivize people to get out of public housing and into their own home ownership and get jobs. So I tied in jobs with housing and all the and jobs, housing and transportation have to be all interconnected. Because without any of those three, the whole thing falls apart. And of course, the other sector is if you have mental health or addiction issues, forget those three. If you don't solve those issues first, forget the others. Because you can see that all around the streets. And, you know, in LA and San Francisco and even Charlotte and Winston, when you let people lay out on the streets and set up temps, all you're doing is enabling and making the situation worse, where you think you're doing good by giving someone $10 or something, but you're actually doing worse.
So yeah, I know this issue extremely well.
There is no easy solution, but I believe in results. Target, know your audience, know the need, and fix that need before you put all the capital investment in. Habitat for Humanity, I learned, for example, we were having people buy Habitat houses, and then we'd have creditors come and say, put a second mortgage on your, to buy your dishwasher or your, or whatever you need extra in the house, your laundry. They put a second mortgage on their home, not realize the impact of that. And so what would happen 3 years later, they'd lose their Habitat home. So Habitat, for example, learned, we won't allow you to put a second mortgage on your home, and we're going to put you through financial acumen training so you understand the operations cost of keeping a home.
Yep. You talk a lot about labor. You also mentioned labor in our last conversation. Many people believe that one way we could address the labor shortage is by addressing our broken immigration system. What are your ideas on how to address such a complex system? And when I say that, I think a lot of times when people talk about immigration, we have this fixation just on the southern border, but immigration is so much larger than that. We've got a lot of Indians that come here to work, a lot of Asians, a lot of Canadians.
All over Africans, Asians.
How do we address that complex system?
Well, I was actually dealing with this in 1995 as a mayor, and those comments as mayor are being used in negative ads against me. Of course, they take a little clip, and Ted Budd ought to be shameful about what they're doing or the Club for Growth. Because I've studied the immigration. It's legal and illegal immigration. It's split up in two areas. And what I recommended in my mayor's report was that we strictly enforce illegal immigration, but we broaden legal immigration from across the world, not just Latino countries, but from Asia, Africa, Europe, who every day there are people waiting at embassies across the world wanting to get into our country. And we have a process to get more people here to work and enjoy our freedom, but the bureaucracy is held up and we don't have a policy to direct those people to where we need them based upon skills needed, based upon need, regions. And instead we just have an open border, which we got to be careful about the simulation too. Our country's greatest strength is the simulation, becoming Americans. And I think we're becoming much more tribal by bringing up, you know, race, gender, sex, sexuality. Hey, we're all Americans. We're all individuals, regardless of our skin color. We're all the same. We all bleed the same. And but if we don't assimilate as a country, as we've done, we've gone through different periods of this, European immigrants, you know, we had the Irish neighborhoods, the German neighborhoods, the Polish neighborhoods, even though they're all white. They all hated each other. Mm-hmm. There were different cultures, different languages. Then when the African-American community, many went from the South to the urban areas after the Civil War and later to get jobs and to get freedom. We then had the African-American neighborhoods. We were segregated. And then as we've gone for the last 50 to 100 years, we're assimilating. We have to assimilate. Or we'll be tribal like the Balkans. And when you're tribal like the Balkans, you end up fighting each other, not if, but when. Mm-hmm. And we cannot do that. That's the great American experiment is all these different races and cultures and languages coming into America, but sooner or later having the melting pot. We're all Americans, regardless.
And by doing so, the best ideas always come up to the top. You know, I always share with my audience that, you know, growing up, I grew up with my grandfather. Yeah. And my grandfather, you know, he obviously grew up in America during a time when he wasn't, you know, much appreciated. But despite the way this country always treated him, he always reminded me how much he loved America. And he always told me that this was the best thing going on the planet. And he used to tell me, if you can find a better system that's available right now, I'm happy to move there. But I don't think that exists. And I remind folks, because I hear a lot of young folks nowadays, I think the culture around how we appreciate our country and love our country has been gradually shifting. And the next generation doesn't seem to have that same cultural roots that we have. But I always remind people, I see a lot of people dying to get in this country. I don't see no one dying to get out of it. So I do think we have a great country here, and I would agree with your
by the way, every there. Older generation feels like the next generation doesn't get it, but sooner or later, I'm convinced the next generation gets it. They just can't wait too long in getting it.
That's right.
And often it takes the time. Second or third generation of immigrants, you know, the first generation of every immigrant culture that's come to America, was the hardest working. And then as the generations went on, we all wanted our handouts or giveaways, and every generation has done that. So the new generation, every new generation of the people who are avoiding terrible circumstances, whether it be Africa or Central America, coming here, they're coming here for a reason, for freedom and opportunity. And we better not forget it. But often it's the second, third generation that, mom and dad, I know what you came in, but I don't have to work as hard. It's a national thing, but
usually
by the time they get in their 30s and 40s, 50s, they go, you're right, we are the greatest nation.
I'm constantly reminding my daughter of it every day and trying to get her to remind her friends of it. You've made some comments about your opponents. Obviously you've made some comments about Congressman Budd, who is in the race. Yeah, most people noticed that Congressman Budd has yet to show up to one of these debates. What do you think that says about this race if you can't get a candidate to show up for a debate?
It's shameful, and it's an embarrassment to my party. I was debating. I'm a little behind in the polls now, but when I was ahead in the polls, I was going, let's debate. It's the right thing to do. These campaigns shouldn't be bought and paid for. And right now we've got an outside interest group that, with all due respect to the congressman, he's hiding behind 90% of the ads are negative toward me, and they're working and they're untruthful. So I'm sure his handlers are going, hey, stay away. The ads are working. But it's wrong. It's wrong for America. It's wrong for democracy that we don't stand up and confront and defend and be able to talk about our vision. I've never avoided debates, even when I was 30 points ahead in polls for mayor. I always debated my opponent. It's the American thing to do. And frankly, Ted should be shameful that he's not doing it. I mean, we've got a debate, our third debate this Thursday, statewide TV. He's not showing. And his spokesman is going, well, we're going to go out and meet people. No, he was at a fundraiser last week. So at least be truthful. I mean, you're either doing it for one of three reasons. You're trying to sit on a lead and hide, and hopefully you can hang on, kind of like what Biden did. You might be incompetent and can't defend your record. Or three, you got other people paying for commercials to get your message out. And you'll have to ask Mr. Budd. He's not just not debating. He's not talking to media. Very rarely is he talking to media and have an in-depth conversation. So we can tell what candidates actually know what they're talking about and have experience and wisdom and knowledge and solutions to some very complex problems like we just did about housing. And we could spend an hour on housing. And I don't know if Ted could, because I'm the only one who's running that has a city council experience, a mayor's experience, and a governor's experience, and private sector experience. And that's what we need in Washington. Ted, and with all due respect to Mark, who I like, I have nothing personal against either one. Their only experience is they went straight to Washington. A lot of the issues, like you asked me, what can Washington do about that issue? I probably didn't give the answer that you wanted, because I actually think that's a local responsibility on zoning. I understand that if everyone's involved in zoning, we'll get nothing done. You can only have one decision maker in some of these areas. But if you have four different governments and the private sector involved, you're going to have confusion and get nothing done. But it would have been easy for me to appease you and go, oh, yeah, I want to do this. No, I won't do that. I won't play that game. And Ted should be debating. We've got one Thursday night, Spectrum TV. Statewide, we've got another one in High Point the week after, and he's just they're not even returning calls.
Yeah, I've called a couple of the debates that you guys have had so far, and I mean I think they've been very, very good discussions, very thoughtful conversations. What kind of message does this send to other Republicans, whether it be candidates who might want to run in the future or even voters who are paying attention right now?
It's a terrible message for democracy that the only way to get elected is to have an outside interest group spend on negative ads and win your campaign through negative ads and hide. And it's bipartisan. We've got Ted Budd doing it. You know, we had Biden, I could say, did it most of his race, but at least he debated. But he hid most of the other time, didn't do a lot of press conferences. It's not a good sign to convince people to run, because most people don't have the capability to have an outside group spend $15 million. And plus, from a personal standpoint, I have no means to correct the ad. I don't have the money. I've raised $5 million or so, which is a heck of a lot of money. But when you have one group outspending you 4-1, 3-1, that's a big advantage. It's not right. These outside groups should not be buying a North Carolina seat. We need to send a message that the North Carolina Senate seat's not for sale, and neither am I. I've never been for sale, and I won't be. Because if you're beholden to an outside interest group, or frankly, even to an endorsement, which he got the major endorsement from the former president, do you owe them something? Do you have to do what they say once you're elected? And I don't like to be beholden to anyone except for the voters. And my knowledge, it's a republic where I represent the voters, but I don't necessarily have to, whoever endorses me or pays for my advertisement, you do feel beholden. I don't care what anyone says, you are beholden, and you give them more attention than everyone else, and it's wrong.
Well, you know, from my audience, who I know I've got a lot of smart, thoughtful people who listen to the show, which I'm very thankful of, to my audience, I encourage everyone to really research the issues. Everyone that listens to me know that I don't buy into the commercials. I don't buy into the ads. I don't buy into the talking points. You really want to be listening to thoughtful conversation with any candidate that asks for your vote, not just the people that are running at the top of the ticket, but the people all the way to the bottom of the ticket.
There are 14 people running for the U.S. Senate. All good. There's a kid out of High Point. Love the guy, Ken Harper. I shouldn't be promoting someone else, but nice guy. I went to school. His uncle was, I played peewee football with him. We were in fifth grade, African-American young man. And he had a big influence in my life when I moved from Ohio to North Carolina in fifth grade, because in Ohio was segregated. North Carolina was more integrated actually in 1967. And I remember, I just happened to ask him, you don't happen to be related to Charlie Harper, do you? Charles Harper. And he went, yeah, it's my uncle. It's a small world, but we got 14 people out there that have been working, and Bud's living off TV ads, which are disgraceful. They have ads which show me, like, as governor, he appointed all these liberals who believe in critical race theory on the school board textbook committee. It's a total lie. State statute says the Board of Education superintendent appoints them or submits the names, and I have no choice but to appoint them. It's very deceitful. And, if you're willing to lie to become a U.S. senator, most likely you'll lie as a U.S. senator. And
again, to my audience, I really, really, really do encourage you to just understand all the candidates and understand where they are on the issue, because this is, for Republicans, this is a big decision that's going to be made in May. Whoever wins this race is the person that's going to meet Sherry Beasley in the general.
And she's going to be tough.
And she's going to be very tough. And I think you, as Republicans, you want to know where your candidate is on some of these issues. And so you need to be looking for that. Governor, before I have to let you go, one last question. What do you think is the biggest issue facing North Carolina voters right now?
Inflation. Just number one on everyone's book. There are many other issues. Mental health, by the way, and addiction is a family society issue that we've got to deal with. No one talks about that, but I do. But inflation, if these energy prices, housing prices, food prices keep going up, we're literally going to bankrupt the middle class and starve some people. And that's not America. That's not America. So we got to unleash America's energy resources. And even Biden now is unleashing some resources last week, which completely go contrary of what he's been saying for a year. So it's kind of a contradictory message, but reality is now facing him. And we've got to be pragmatic and real about this inflation, or we're in trouble. Because I grew up with inflation in the early 70s when I was in high school and in Triad there. And I tell you, there's no easy solution to inflation. So you got to confront
it. Yeah, once it creeps in, it's hard to get out. But, you know, for my audience, if you heard the governor's comment there, the Biden administration has backtracked. They are now allowing or they will be issuing permits for energy exploration on federal land. That was something I was on record back when they actually took that off the table over a year ago. I thought that was a crazy move. a lot of the moves they made in the first 90 days or 60 days when they came into office, they're now having to go and backtrack because they realized that the way the policies were before actually worked. And so they're having to go back to those.
But the dilemma is, even by giving those permits on federal land, you're going to have a lot of people go, I'm not going to do that, because you've also said by the year 2030, we're going to outlaw fossil fuels. Well, why would I make a huge capital investment in getting drilling equipment, knowing you're going to pull the rug out from under me before I can pay my debt? So it's, you know, one of Biden's greatest weaknesses, regardless of liberal or conservatives, he's never run a business. He's been a lawyer and a politician the whole time. You know, it's like, he said this in a State of the Union speech where he said, why don't employers just lower their prices and raise their wages to deal with inflation? I mean,
yeah, just completely out of touch. I would say, I've been saying this, if you want to get energy prices to come down, because, and you know this, Governor, you've been in the industry. Energy is so intertwined and globally intertwined. The fastest way to get energy prices to come down would be the president announcing that he is going to now start allowing offshore drilling in the Atlantic OCS. If he announced that today, you would immediately see energy prices come down immediately, because people would know there's going to be so much more supply hitting the market. So the president does have the ability to do something about this. He's just doing the wrong things. You know, Governor, I always appreciate you joining me. Thank you for locking in again. And to my audience, make sure you take a moment, go learn more about former North Carolina Governor Pat McCrory. He is asking for your vote for the United States Senate. He is in a primary fight. So if you're a Republican, he is specifically asking for your vote on May 17th. So go learn more about
early voting. Early voting starts in 10 days, I think. And remind everyone that independents can vote in the Republican primary. So if you're a registered independent, you can go vote, and you pick then at the ballot whether you want to go independent on the entire ballot or you go either Republican or Democrat. So if you're independent and you want to input into this Republican primary, we ask for the independent votes too, and the Republicans.
Well, you heard it here. Early voting starts here soon. Let your voice be heard. You can go online. You can read more about former Governor Pat McCrory. I'm sure he's got a Facebook page, web page, all those great things. I know I follow him on Twitter and Instagram, so I keep up with you there. But, go learn more about him. Learn more about all the races. You know, we had Aaron Berlin was on last week, who is actually in line to be the next Superior Court judge here in Forsyth County. And we were talking about how important judicial races are. So a lot of races happening this year, and you should be paying attention. Always stay tuned to WTOB, because that is where you can lock in every Sunday morning at 7:30 a.m. But if you happen to miss the conversation on WTOB, you can always download, subscribe, and download the podcast on Apple, Spotify, Pandora. Wherever you like to get your favorite podcast, you can lock in with me there. And then also make sure you are following Algernon Cash on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. And until next time, y'all stay locked in.
The executive producer of the Locked In podcast is Algernon Cash for WCG. The associate producer is Tim Beeman for Such and Such Media. The views and opinions in this podcast are solely those of the contributors and are not necessarily those of our distributors or hosting company. This podcast is copyrighted and cannot be reproduced without express written consent of WGC.